This podcast was brought to you by Business Radio, powered by Wharton, originally airing on Sirius XM.
Welcome to our Behind the Markets podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz. Alongside Wharton Frank Professor Jeremy Siegel, we tackle the latest market trends every week on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM, Channel 132. Welcome to Behind the Markets here on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz, Global CIO at WisdomTree. I'm joined by my co-host, Wharton Finance Professor Jeremy Siegel, who is also Senior Economist for WisdomTree. I should note, I'm a registered representative of Foreside Fund Services. Our discussion is not tied to the offers of any investment products, and our views of our guests are their own and not those of WisdomTree affiliates. We have a really interesting show. We have Peter Berezin, who's the Chief Global Strategist for BCA Research. They do a lot of publishing on the global markets and the economy. We're going to get his views of what's happening. But Professor, a lot of data on the tapes, another good report. What's your view? The markets are celebrating after a little bit of pullback on Thursday. How are you looking at things?
Yeah. Employment Friday payroll was strong. Everything else hit pretty much expectations. Payroll widely, you know, described as strong, with also a slight upward revision the previous 2 months. We had the unemployment rate drop 3.8. You know, we said the sweet point for sweet area of unemployment is 3.6 to 4. We just backed right into the middle of that particular range. I also was happy to see average hours worked bounce up to 34.4, which, as you know, we talked about how much it fell earlier in the year and then got kind of revised up. I mean, that's a really positive. We're back up now to really the 24-year average of what the average hourly input is into that process. A slight tick up in participation rate, which was, also very good. Now, the question is, how does this feed into what the Fed is going to do? Honestly, it's more important the CPI that we and the PPI that we get next week, I think that's going to be a key factor. Again, we look at the shelter component of that very importantly, because the rise in the shelter, which we think is overstated by the BLS, has been 2/3 of the increase of the CPI year over year, as admitted in the releases that we had. So I think the CPI is really going to dominate, perhaps even more importantly than not. Early call, by the way, is that the year-over-year core is going to decelerate 3.7, which would be the lowest level on CPI core year-over-year since the pandemic began. Our other favorite indicator, the unemployment claims, actually ticked up right again into exactly the middle of our range, 220,000. We said we like it between 200 and 240. So both the unemployment rate and that has moved right to the center, not too hot, not too cold. So is there anything to worry about? The only thing I'm watching with, I'm being slightly unsettled by, and I don't want to overemphasize this, is the rise in commodity prices. Now, we know some of it is due to oil, and we know, potential heating up of the situation in the Middle East, is causing oil, but it is now in other commodities more than just oil. Is that a precursor to a big, another inflationary? I don't think so. I think it has to do with the strength of the economy, raising a lot of those commodity prices. But as we have been saying for weeks and weeks and weeks, all the commodity index, Goldman Sachs, Bloomberg, et cetera, have broken out from their downtrends and have started upward. And particularly this week was one of the strongest weeks we had, actually, I think, since the Russian invasion in Ukraine. Bears watching on heat in the system. I was also a little surprised. James Border, you know, was with Super Hawk at the Fed. He's now, dean of the business school at Purdue, but he was on CNBC this morning and actually was relatively dovish, thinking that it is time to lower the rates. I thought he would be hawkish given the strength of the economy. Again, he's not a voting member anymore, but, he was a very influential member of the FOMC during his many-year tenure there. It's obviously the implication for earnings are great. We're going to start getting earnings, next week and earnings season and how the first quarter goes. The GDP estimates are somewhere between 2 and 2.5, which are good for this quarter. As far as it's not too hot, not too cold, except bearing watching on those commodity prices to see whether they settle down if tensions settle down in the Middle East or not. But nothing to me. I still think the trend of equity prices is upward and the momentum is still there. Certainly today, despite the rise in yields for 4 or 5 basis points, at least here in midday, we're having a really good rally, sort of a relief rally that nothing came in overly hot on the wage front, which has been the sensitive area for the market in today's report.
Well, let me bring in Peter Bereson quickly for some comments. Peter, you guys, as you think about your outlook for the second half of the year, how's your read of the economy? Do you think there's risk building up? Do you see flashing signs on the horizon?
Yeah, I would say I'm probably less concerned than Professor Siegel over rising commodity prices. To me, that largely reflects some strength that we're seeing in global manufacturing. You know, the PMI numbers have generally been stronger. And also, I think a sense that many investors have that China will do more to stimulate its economy in order to reach that 5% growth target. Where I am, I think, a little bit more worried is over the underlying health of the U.S. labor market and the U.S. consumer. So today's employment numbers were generally strong. I certainly agree with that. But I would note that full-time employment has now fallen for 4 straight months. If you look at kind of the ratio of full-time employment to the size of the labor force, that typically declines in the lead up to recessions. I think that's somewhat concerning. The number of so-called permanent job losers. So remember, unemployment can rise for good reasons when people who are out of the labor force re-enter, or it could rise for bad reasons. People who are working lose their jobs. We are seeing the number of permanent job losers trend higher, at least if you're going to smooth out the data a little bit. That is somewhat concerning. And I think more broadly, I'm skeptical of the whole narrative that the U.S. consumer, which of course accounts for 70% of the economy, will remain as strong as it has been for the last couple of years. I certainly see a reason to think that savings are going to have to rise, and that could imperil the economic outlook.
Yeah, I can understand your point. I do think that one of the offsets to the lack of savings or the using up of the pandemic savings, as many have talked about over the last year, is of course the rise in wealth values, equity in homes for those who own homes, which is 2/3 of the Americans, the rise of stock prices. Some analysts have even talked about, Bitcoin coming back and, and the margins, I read somewhere the marginal propensity of these young people to spend out of their Bitcoin gains is much higher than out of stock market gains, 2 to 1. So there, obviously, I think there's a cushion there. And I think if there's not a worry about getting that new job, that's why I look at some of these sensitive ones. And you look at others that I haven't looked at as closely yet, maybe bear watching. But at this particular time, I think there's still a lot of confidence that I could get the job. It's not a hot job market the way it was, a year, 2 years ago. when there was really a shortage, but that there are jobs available and 3%. We also had a good household report. We see growth in the household level as well as that payroll level. So I hope you're right about the, you know, I did argue that last week that was the strength of the economy bringing about commodity prices. This week, I think you have more, you know, oil topping 90 and other commodities beginning to go up, some of which could be also fear. If there's a Mideast problem, then there could be shipping problems. We know what happened on, you know, around already around the African East Coast. So, you know, let's I think we have to wait and see if that settles out. Some people have said that April is a good month, but the second, well, usually first half of months is better than second half of months. But for April, it's the reverse because of the fact that people have to pay all their taxes on the 15th. I mean, those that do. And then once that's out of the way, they do better in the second half. I don't know how much seasonality there is there, April is historically a very, very good month. Problems come in May and June if there's other problems in the economy.
Yeah, that's right. Sell in May and go away, right?
Yeah, sell in May and go away. Well, we're 4 weeks away from that.
Peter, one comment I've seen a lot of people comment on the full-time versus part-time, and that you have lower full-time jobs today than you did 12 months ago. But, you know, one of the charts, one of my colleagues, Sam Ryans, has been putting out has said, you know, if you look at the part-time for econ versus non-economic reasons, you know, for economic reasons, it's actually been drifting downwards because people, sort of older people wanting to be retired and sort of partly attached to the labor force. But then the actual, for non-economic reasons, has been trending higher. Is that part of that explanation that you think makes sense?
I think it's part of it. So when the labor market is strong, maybe someone who is sort of on the borderline of wanting to work will step in and get a job, and it might be a part-time job. There might be people who want a second job because wages are rising. And so you can see some of that happen. But again, you got to look at the absolute level of full-time jobs. That's shrinking. That is concerning. Now, it could be just noise in the data. The household survey is much more noisy than the establishment survey, but it certainly bears watching. And on the, Professor Siegel mentioned something interesting with respect to household wealth being elevated and that helping to reduce savings. So there certainly is a very strong association with household wealth as a share of income and the savings rate. Right now, the savings rate is 3.6%. So it was over 7% in 2019. It's much lower now than it was back then. You can justify a low savings rate based on household wealth only if you have some mechanism by which that household wealth can be translated into spending. So back in the housing bubble period, what happened was that people were monetizing their wealth by taking out these home equities lines of credit using the houses that they owned as collateral for borrowing. We haven't seen so much of that this time around. Rather, what's been happening is that people have been borrowing a lot more on their credit cards, and credit card debt rose 15% in the fourth quarter of last year relative to the fourth quarter of 2022. Unfortunately, if you look at, say, the Senior Loan Officer survey, there's a question in that survey that asks banks the degree to which they want to continue extending consumer credits. Their willingness has declined over the last 18 months or so, which does suggest that credit card borrowings will decelerate. And so if people can't continue to spend by taking on more and more debt, they're going to have to spend less, and that could push up the savings rate. And of course, the other thing that is worth mentioning is that those excess pandemic savings, by most estimates, have largely been run out. So again, I do see some concern that households, whether they want to or not, will be forced to cut spending and raise savings. And that could be challenging for the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a good point in the HELOC loans, home equity loan, lines of credit, which were very, very popular during the housing boom of the pre-financial crisis, are much less now. First of all, tighter standards on getting them. Secondly, of course, right now with interest rates up, the prime rate at 3 points above the Fed funds rate, which is our 8, and then they scale up from there 9 and 10. You might get more because the credit cards are 18 and 19 or 20. So some advisors might say, well, hey, you're better off taking a home equity line of credit there. So we might see some conversion over there. There's margin, you could obviously borrow. You could sell your stocks, or if you don't want to take the tax consequence, if you've got gains, you can always, do a loan against those at much lower rates, certainly, than the credit cards. Depending on, but I think that also shows a vulnerability if markets turn south under those. If you're using the wealth to pin up your consumption, that could be a problem going forward.
Well, Professor, I know you have a lunch that you do every Friday,
yes.
So we'll let you say goodbye, and then we'll turn our courage to Peter for the rest of the show.
Yeah, well, thank you, Peter, and thank you, Jeremy, and we'll talk to you next week.
Very good.
Great talking to you, Professor.
Yes.
So, Peter, I've been reading a bunch of your notes. And so Peter's the Chief Global Strategist at BCA Research. And I saw your sort of second quarter review. And maybe you could start. We touched a little bit on the face of the economy. But I think the bottom line highlighted on page one was the odds of recession, global recession, are rising. Is you talked a little bit about some of these factors, but is the odds now tilted more in the favor of weakness than growth at the current phase?
I think they are. So last year we were bullish on stocks. The start of 2023, we called for this benign disinflation, or immaculate disinflation, as some people have been calling it, on the grounds that labor demand would fall across the economy, but unemployment wouldn't rise because you had that insulation from very high job openings. What would happen, we predicted, was that firms would lay off workers, but those workers would just walk across the street and find new work, and so unemployment wouldn't go up. But that reduction in labor demand would still have the effect of reducing wage growth. And that's sort of what happened. What I'm worried about now is kind of where we are in terms of that normalization of the labor market. If you look at the gap between labor demand and labor supply, there's still an excess demand for workers, but that so-called jobs workers gap has shrunk by around two-thirds from its peak. And if the current trend continues, we could be looking at labor demand falling short of labor supply by the end of the year. And if that were to happen, unemployment would start to rise. And of course, when unemployment starts rising, it usually keeps rising because people who lose their jobs don't have as much income. They spend less, and so others lose their job. I am kind of concerned that we are heading in that direction, not imminently, but towards the end of this year or early next year.
And is there a trigger, or is it just the cumulative impact of this tightening? This is like the tightening and the 5% interest rates finally showing up, or is there something else at play here?
That's the interesting thing. It could be something else, but it doesn't have to be something else. So the analogy I often like to make is water that's getting colder and colder and colder. You put a warm glass of water into the freezer, it remains liquid. It doesn't change for a while, but then when the temperature falls to 0 Celsius, as we would say here in Canada, then what happens is that you get this state transition from liquid to solid. The same thing can happen to economies. Economies can freeze over if their temperature falls far enough. And what's happening now is that the temperature of the economy is declining, which you can see in this sort of weakening trend in job openings, the weakening trend in the quits rate, the weakening trend in the hiring rate. But it hasn't frozen over yet. But if the temperature continues to fall, than it will. So that's one possibility, that you have kind of recession that sort of starts almost from nothing. Another possibility is that there is some sort of additional force that pushes the economy into recession. What could that be? You know, it's hard to say. Professor Siegel mentioned the increase in commodity prices. I think so far much of that has been driven by better demand outlook. But if we have a supply shock, that could definitely imperil the economy. And of course, the other thing to mention, we were talking about this last year, but everyone has now forgotten about those regional banks. The problems in the regional banks have not gone away. Those losses on their books are still there. They haven't raised enough new capital. And so that could be a source of concern for the economy.
Yeah, I talk about that a bit, and the banks like still don't pay people appropriate interest rates. So there's still a lot of money sitting in banking accounts earning nothing when, you know, the money market funds have been 5%. And so there's still a lot of money that should be leaving the banks to these other places now. So that could hurt their profit pool even more. But people have been happy. We talk a little bit about M2 and money supply on this show, and sort of that was one of Siegel's early indicators of, hey, there's going to be a lot of inflation because of the explosion money supply. Then he got worried as it started collapsing. I don't know how much you focus on the growth of M2 and the drivers of that. Is that something tied into the banking dynamics that you think about at all?
Well, it certainly matters. I think it matters less than it once did. And the correlation between, say, M2 growth and GDP growth has been fairly weak since the early 1980s. And a lot of what's kind of driving down M2 growth now is the fact that people did accumulate all those excess savings during the pandemic and have sort of been spending that down. And that's causing bank deposits to fall. And that's the key component of M2. I'm more focused kind of on the credit side. Credit growth has slowed, and in some categories, it continues to slow. Now, it's true that bank lending standards did not tighten as much in the last quarter as they did in prior quarters, but they're still tightening. They're still getting tighter at the margin. So it does look as though the banking system may not be able to extend the sort of credit that it needs to extend to keep the economy on track. Now, people say, well, what about private markets? Isn't there like a huge amount of money there? There is a lot of money, and that's helping. But if you look at, say, the corporate default rates in the high yield market, that has increased from about 2% to over 6%. So that's happened despite the fact that there is money from private credit available. That's telling you that money is just not enough. And what's amazing, if you look at the spread on high yield debt, the current spread is very, very low. And the default rate would have to fall in half from over 6% down towards 3.5% just to justify the current level of corporate debt spreads. And what that implies in turn is that there is quite a lot of complacency amongst investors over the economic outlook.
So as you start thinking about these probabilities, so probability of recession increasing, the spreads in credit, sounds like you don't want to be in high yield bonds, maybe even some of the other credit types of instruments. How are you thinking about factoring that into your baseline for equities? You're, I think, recommending today still a neutral allocation, down from being overweight before, but a neutral allocation to stocks today. When do you see, what is there a trigger of, obviously this could be some of your secret sauce, but how do you think about when you will increasingly lower your equity risk?
Well, my rule of thumb is that you don't want to be underweight stocks unless you're quite confident that a recession is around the corner. Now, I do think that we're heading towards a recession, but my base case is that the recession starts towards the end of this year or early next year. And historically, at least on average, stocks have tended to peak 6 months before the onset of recession. So there's still a little bit of time left. Now, do you want to be long? Probably not. But do you want to be short? I'm looking for a little bit more confirmation that recession is imminent before I go underweight stocks. It could happen within the next few months, but you know, I'm following the data like everyone else. Right now, the data is saying that I probably will need to turn underweight later this year, but right now it might still be slightly too early.
Now, is there, within that view of equities, is there become sectors you favor, sort of knowing that you're getting a little bit more cautious, but not ready to pull the trigger?
Yeah, so I think the sector that I really like going into year end is healthcare. Healthcare has really lagged the S&P. That's partly because profit margins within the healthcare system have been weakening. That should change because healthcare prices are very sticky. Typically, they're negotiated using fairly long-term contracts. As these prices reset, we're going to see a little bit of upward pressure on profit margins within the healthcare sector. And of course, the other thing is that healthcare is very defensive, right? People need healthcare regardless of what the economy is doing. And that in turn should allow defensive sectors like healthcare to do well in an environment where recession risks are rising. So healthcare would be top of my list. But I think consumer staples, utilities are also two sectors I would like to overweight later this year.
So healthcare, is that as part of the there's certainly very different types of healthcare. There's in the headlines, even just the recent few weeks, has been the sort of insurers like Humana who got hit on some other billing type questions. And anytime you have an election season, it becomes extra fodder for, hey, we're paying too much in healthcare in the U.S. in particular. And those companies said, or is it the drugs? You know, we've talked about the biotech companies being some of the beneficiaries of this AI revolution, where you know all of DNA is just data, and so if you have huge explosions in data processing capabilities with AI, maybe that's going to lead to a lot more innovation in biotech. So I agree in some ways on the innovation side, but do you have a particular part of healthcare that you like, or is it just the broad sector?
Yeah, I mean, I think the drug makers are a little bit more immune to some of these political issues that could afflict health insurers. Now, in the case of insurers, a lot will depend on who wins the election in November. If Joe Biden prevails, then yeah, there could be some downward pressure on margins. We'll just have to wait and see. But in general, I would say even amongst the insurers, environment where the economy is souring, they'll probably still outperform the more cyclical parts of the stock market, such as consumer discretionary companies, materials companies, industrials, and so on.
So you mentioned the defensive. So now healthcare the top, maybe staples. Utilities have been one of these rate sensitive sectors, have been really been struggling, but is partly view rates come down during the recession, which may be one of the reasons why you like utilities going there for when the recession call comes.
Exactly. So I'm not, extremely bullish on bonds at the moment because the recession is not imminent. But once that recession begins, the Fed is going to have to cut rates aggressively. And so bond yields are going to fall, and any equity sector that's sort of tied to bond yields should do relatively well. And of course, utilities are also extremely defensive, so they should do well in kind of a weaker economic growth environment.
Now, you mentioned banks being part of the regional banks not being completely out of the woods, that they still have these issues. Is that partly tied to real estate? And do you have, that's been one of these sectors also impacted by rates the most, you could say. How do you look at real estate as a sector today?
Yeah, so, the regional banks are the primary lenders to commercial real estate. They account for 70% of lending to commercial real estate. The big banks only account for 30%. So if the regional banks need to pull back lending, commercial real estate will really feel the pinch. Right now, the office sector is still struggling, continues to struggle. What might be interesting is what happens over the remainder of the year to other parts of commercial real estate. So the part of CRE that I'm becoming increasingly worried about is multifamily real estate. A lot of really bad deals were made in 2021. People who bought apartments who really had no history in managing apartments, they just kind of assume the rents would continue to rise indefinitely. The financing costs would remain low. Obviously, that didn't happen. Asking rents have been flat now for over a year, and financing costs have increased significantly. So we're going to see more defaults in the apartment sector. We're going to see also less construction in the apartment sector. There's a huge wave of supply that's hitting the market. Builders know that. They've been pulling back on the number of projects that they've initiated. So that could also weaken the economy to some extent.
Now, you're based in Canada, and we focused so far, I think, on the U.S. markets. But how do you think globally, if you were to say where around the world you want to be positioned, is there a view on recessions? Is it a global recession? Is it a U.S. recession? Is there any markets outside the U.S. you like better than the U.S.?
Yeah, well, you know the old adage, when the U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. So I think if the U.S. heads down, we're going to see a global recession rather than a U.S.-specific recession. And I have to say, like, the problems in Europe, in China, do look rather worrisome. So in the case of Europe, the economy there is much more sensitive to bank lending than non-bank lending. And what we're going to see, especially in countries such as Italy and Spain, which have done kind of okay over the last 12 months, the real weakness hasn't been in Italy or Spain, it's been in Germany. But those economies in Southern Europe have a lot of short-term debt, a lot of interest rate. A lot of loans are going to be reset to higher rates. That's going to be a problem. And of course, in the case of Italy, you also have a huge amounts of government debt. And so there could be some new concern that resurfaces over that perpetual issue. So I am worried about Europe towards the end of this year. Right now, I think Europe is okay because they're benefiting from some stabilization in global manufacturing activity, but that might not last into year end. And then in the case of China, there you still have this ongoing problem in the housing market, which is only getting worse. Like, housing starts in China are down 60% from their peak. Home prices haven't fallen that much, largely because the government tries to regulate home prices, especially in the primary market. In the secondary market, they are falling quite noticeably, and they have a lot further to fall. Like, Chinese homes relative to incomes, relative to rents, are extremely expensive, arguably even more expensive than Japanese homes were in the early 1990s. So there's a real chance that China will follow the same path as Japan towards this sort of deflationary quagmire, which certainly wouldn't be good news for the global economy.
A lot of people want to try to time the bottom of China's markets. They see, hey, the U.S. looks expensive. A lot of these China companies look cheap. And hey, their tech companies are way cheaper than the U.S. But there's all sorts of these issues about this. And, you know, Siegel talked about, hey, there's a wealth effect in the U.S. where people have stocks here. There, it's very home price centric, right? They have a lot more of their wealth in homes than in stocks.
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, you know, if you want to trade the Chinese market, that's perfectly fine. In fact, I've sort of been playing around with Chinese tech stocks over the last couple of months because I think the government wants share prices to rise, and they'll probably succeed in lifting share prices over like a horizon of like 6 months or so. But structurally, it's going to be about earnings growth. And there, I think you have to be more concerned, not just about the underlying state of the Chinese economy, but also in terms of government regulation and generally the direction in which the direction in which policymaking is going. So as a trade, China, I think, makes sense. As a long-term investor, I would be much more skeptical.
Peter, your team does a lot of publishing on something called the macro quant model. Tell us, what is a macro quant model? What goes into it, and how BCA Research utilizes this?
About our views. You know, if there's an opinion, it has to be informed by the data. And so the way the model came to be is that I would ask my team for various indicators that I thought might be useful in predicting the direction of the economy, the direction of financial markets. And after a while, I assembled this very long list of indicators. And then the question was, okay, how do you kind of take all of those indicators and distill them into a single signal that could be used to inform one's view on whether to be overweight, neutral, or underweight stocks? And so what we did, so we created like a learning algorithm that weighs every indicator by how well it has done in predicting the direction of financial markets. So it's sort of like a good trader. You get a bit of a bonus if you do well. And so in this model, every indicator that's been doing a good job of predicting the direction of the S&P 500, the direction of bond yields, gets a bit of a weight. So there are different components of the model. There's a stock component, there's a bond component, there's sector components, there's global regional components, there are commodity components, and all of those components talk to each other to generate internally consistent signals. And there are a lot of different indicators that we look at. Each one has been individually tested to make sure that it does have leading properties for the financial markets. And so we look at kind of the aggregate signal from all of those indicators. And what's interesting is that that signal has shifted over the last couple of weeks. The model was quite bullish on stocks last year. It remained overweight on stocks right through March. And then right at the end of March, it started to get a little bit cautious. And just in the last few days, it has moved into bearish territory. Now, it's still early days. Things could change, but the model is signaling an increased need for caution on risk assets.
So how is it more economic data? Is it more markets data? How would you describe the ratio of how much is high level, because you call it macro quant. So how much is macro? How much is sort of financial markets related?
It depends on what time horizon you look at. So what we've generally found is that if you're looking at very short-term horizons, for example, if you're trying to predict direction of the stock market over the next 1 to 3 months, you want to look very much at technical factors, sentiment, positioning, all of that is in the model. If you want to predict the direction of the markets over a 6 to 12 month horizon, then macro becomes much more important. What's happening to growth? What's happening to inflation? If you want to know what's going to happen to markets beyond the next couple of years, then valuations become critical. So there are different horizons in the model, and the degree to which those various aspects, sentiment, economic growth, valuations are weighted depends on what horizon you're focusing on.
Now, is there some things, like one of the charts you had in your second quarter outlook was that unemployment is inversely related to returns, you know, that you say you actually want the market when you have high unemployment, very counterintuitive to say, hey, strong economy versus weak economy. Is that, that goes into all this as well?
It does. So that particular indicator helps inform kind of a 12-month view on stocks. And it is absolutely true. If you look at the relationship between the unemployment rate and equity returns, what you see is the opposite of what you might expect. What you see is that stocks typically do well when unemployment is high. Now, of course, today, unemployment is low, and that is a potential problem for equities. And the interesting question is, like, why does that relationship exist? Well, partly it's because stocks tend to be more expensive when unemployment is low. But it's also because, and this is what I think is central, it's also because unemployment doesn't tend to stay low for very long. If you look at a chart of the unemployment rates, it's a highly mean reverting series. It's going up, it's going down. When it gets down to very low levels, it typically starts rising again. And then the follow-up question is like, why? Well, why can't it just go down and stay down? And I think the answer is that when you get to full employment, it's just hard to keep the economy there. You got to get monetary policy completely right. If monetary policy is too loose, then you can get a wave of inflation that forces the central bank to slam on the brakes. If monetary policy is too tight, then unemployment starts to rise. and that feeds on itself. So it's a bit like that old Milton Friedman analogy where you're trying to turn the knob in the shower to get the right temperature of the water, but there's a long lag between when you turn the knob and when the water temperature of the water changes. So either too cold or too hot. That, unfortunately, is the predicament that the Fed finds itself in. It has to fine-tune monetary policy given all of these long and variable lags. And so it's just kind of hard to achieve that soft landing. You really need kind of a Goldilocks scenario where you get monetary policy just right. And that, I think, is asking for too much. In fact, in the old Goldilocks story, she gets eaten by the bears. Hopefully that won't happen this time around. But as investors, we have to be attuned to the risks.
Yeah, we've been describing, even you heard the professor kick off with some comments that some of this stuff is a little bit of Goldilocks at the moment. And then the question is, when does it become too restrictive? We've been saying they should uninvert the curve, that they are taking more risk, keeping rates elevated, because we see inflation much lower. But as you see this, where do you think rates will settle to? And so there's the strongly inverted yield curve. What's that saying to you? How do you think rates settle as we go out over the longer run?
Yeah, I mean, there's no direct linkage between the slope of the yield curve and the economy. I mean, nobody in the business sector or the household sector looks at the yield curve and says, oh, I'm going to spend or I'm not going to spend. What an inverted yield curve says is that the market expects rates to go down because the market expects growth to weaken. That's what an inverted yield curve says. Right now, the yield curve is inverted because the market expects the Fed to cut rates, and the Fed will cut rates. It's going to take longer for them to start cutting rates, but they will cut rates. But the problem is that they have to find this balance. They have to be proactive, but not too proactive, because if you're too proactive, then you do run the risk of reheating the economy again and getting that second wave of inflation, which is something that Jay Powell desperately wants to avoid. So can you stick the landing? It's possible. But it's going to be hard. And as investors, I think we need to put in a fairly high probability the Fed errs either on the side of being too loose or too tight and just isn't able to find that perfect balancing act.
So where do you think they bring their rate down to? What is it? You know, they started ticking up. They put their neutral rate at like 50 basis points. They started ticking it up in terms of their real R-star. That, you know, sort of 2.5% is where they settle to over the longer run. They ticked it up like to 260. Where do you think that neutral rate is over the longer run?
So I think the neutral rate is quite a bit higher than what the Fed believes it to be. I think the whole narrative around secular stagnation that was so popular prior to the pandemic, the whole idea of a new normal that Bill Gross was championing, that never made a lot of sense to me. I don't think there was a new normal after the global financial crisis. There was a new abnormal, a period where rates had to be low because you had mass unemployment, because you had a very intense household deleveraging cycle, because you had this massive excess supply of homes. You know, by 2019, that was no longer the case. Unemployment was low. There was a shortage of homes, and the deleveraging cycle had largely ended. So we were talking back then about how rates would probably rise to 5%, which was way above what the market was expecting. Now, ultimately, that did happen. And so we shifted to a much more constructive view on bonds in September of last year. So I think yields will decline during the next recession, which is why I think being overweight bonds makes sense. Will they decline and stay down? I think that's a different issue, because the neutral rate probably is higher than what the Fed thinks it is. So my guess is that the 10-year bond yield will fall to about 3% during the next recession, but then ends up rising towards 4 or 5% by the end of the decade.
Interesting. And so, does that have a positive term premium? So you might say the neutral rate is like 3.5 to 4 is where that's going.
Yeah, I mean the term premium has been very low for, you know, close to 20 years now. It should probably be higher. And the reason it's been so low is because bonds have just been seen as a good hedge against bad economic news. So the stock market goes down, you might lose your job, the value of your home goes down, but at least your bond, the price of the bond goes up. And so you're more willing to hold those long-term bonds because they tend to appreciate during periods of economic worry. But if the worry is not so much weak growth, if after we finish this recession, the worry kind of shifts back again towards inflation, then yeah, you would expect the term premium to be somewhat structurally higher, maybe not 2% like it was in the 1980s and early 90s, but something closer to 0.5% or 1%.
Yeah, we've been talking about inflation. When inflation is the key top of my concern, you get this correlation between stocks and bonds being much more positive. And that's one of the key, you had a negative relationship between stocks and bonds, negative correlation for so long that kept, we're willing to pay insurance to own bonds. They could have a lower required return when they acted as a good hedge, but now no longer. And that might be one of those reasons why that 4 to 5% as your long-term normal makes a lot more sense. What do you think is happening in gold and the dollar today? Gold has been, we're breaking to new highs in dollar terms on gold. Is there more to go on gold? Is it interesting that it's rising in the face of a little bit of higher real rates now?
Yeah, so that correlation, we're talking about correlations breaking, that's another correlation that really broke. Up until like 3 years ago, there was a very close relationship between real bond yields and gold prices. So if you plotted like the TIPS yields versus gold, they would just kind of move in lockstep. And then that relationship broke down, real bond yields went up, but gold didn't fall. In fact, gold has just hit an all-time high. Now, why is that? It's not because of speculative retail interest in gold. In fact, if you look at the amount of gold held in ETFs, such as the GLD, it's been trending lower over the last 3 years. The rise in gold prices seems to be more driven by governments, and in particular, Russia, China, India. These central banks in those countries have been buying a lot more gold, and that's been supporting gold prices. And that, of course, given the geopolitical realities, could continue for a long time. So I'm not wildly bullish on gold because I do see it as being quite expensive relative to real yields, but I don't see the price going down very much either.
What about digital gold? Is Bitcoin an interesting asset? How do you guys view Bitcoin in your work?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of, as you would imagine, there's a lot of debate even within BCA about the merits of cryptocurrencies. I mean, if I try to figure out why the price of Bitcoin has gone up recently, to me, it's like a very simple story about flows. Hey, you've got all these Bitcoin ETFs and people are putting money into those because it's just easier to buy Bitcoin that way, and that's helping to support prices. But it's not about end use. Like, Bitcoin has been around since 2008, and here we are years later, and there's still really no obvious use case for Bitcoin beyond like financial speculation. That to me is a little bit troubling. Very different from like ChatGPT. Like, within hours of ChatGPT being released, people found a use for it. That's not true for a lot of these cryptocurrencies. They remain sort of the providence of speculation. So I would be much more optimistic about cryptos if people actually use them for, say, transactions. But right now, that's not happening.
Now, if you did, I see on your matrix of assets, it's not on the front page where you have an overweight or underweight on Bitcoin. If it were to become a asset that you would add, is it a currency, a commodity? Where would you put it in your buckets of things you would have to grade?
I mean, that's a good question. Somewhere between currencies and commodities. It's a bit like gold. Like, is gold a currency or a commodity? Well, you can kind of think of it in both. But the point is, just like gold, Bitcoin doesn't generate any sort of a yield.
Yeah.
And so if you own Bitcoin, you're owning it for the expectation of price appreciation. Now, at least in the case of gold, it's tied to a rare element. They're not creating any more elements to add to the periodic table. In the case of Bitcoin, it's a little bit more questionable. Yes, you can't create a lot more Bitcoin, but you can create other cryptocurrencies, right, which may compete with Bitcoin. So people are holding Bitcoin because they expect others to see value in Bitcoin. So there is kind of this circular argument, which is a little bit dangerous.
Well, in our final few minutes, and we talked really across assets, across the world, economy, recession, how you all model things at BCA, as you think about who might want to employ your services or other things you'd want to highlight about your approach to looking at markets, what would you tell people is a specialty for BCA research?
Well, what we try to do at BCA is really meld the macro with the market. So a lot of research providers will give you a view on what's going to happen to growth, what will happen to inflation, but then won't kind of translate those views into investment strategies. We try to do that, and our views are informed by decades of research on macroeconomics. We've been around since 1949. We're the oldest independent research provider in the world. We've got a huge database with hundreds of thousands of indicators, many of which are proprietary, many of which we're using in models such as MacroQuant to help inform us on the direction of financial markets and what sort of investment strategy our clients should be adopting.
Well, this has been a fun conversation. I want to hear when your probability goes to overweight recession. Your odds are going to recession, but not really ready to pull the trigger on the underweight to stocks. Perhaps when you guys do make the trigger, you want to come talk about it publicly. Behind the Market's a good place to do that. We can get you with the professor. Talk about it more. It's been a fun conversation, Peter. Thank you so much for joining us here on Behind the Markets. How should people find you if they want to reach out?
They can go to bcaresearch.com. I also have a Twitter account and a LinkedIn account. They can look me up that way.
All right. We'll put some links to that in our podcast recap. You can listen to us on our Behind the Markets podcast every week. Chris in the studio at Wharton, thanks for helping us manage the show today. I'm Jeremy Schwartz. Again, have a great week, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Behind the Markets podcast. If you want to learn more about WisdomTree, visit wisdomtree.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Jeremy D. Schwartz. I'd like to thank Patty Hall for producing our live program on SiriusXM Channel 132 and our podcast producer, Daniel Bruno. Join us next week for another edition of the show.
For more insight from Business Radio, please visit businessradio.wharton.upenn.edu.